Now on Mooney Goes Wild, Derek and Richard Collins hear how Highland cattle are being used to attract a range of bird species in North County Dublin.
Well, Derek, how's this for a view right outside my front door? The great sweep of the Irish Sea in front. Off to the left, we have Malahide Island, which isn't really an island. It's a beautiful sand dune system, a peninsula. Further on, Rockabill. Straight out, you have Lambay, that wonderful island. And to my right, Paddy's Hill. And at the slope of Paddy's Hill, there's a field which has five beautiful, shaggy, long-horned cattle in it.
I can imagine it's very exposed here in the winter, Richard, is it?
Oh, it can be quite brutal. You see the red brick there? I have known that to turn quite white from the salt spray coming in. It can be very, very severe. You need the coat of a Highland cow to survive in this place when the east wind is blowing.
An interesting experiment is taking place outside Richard Collins' home in Malahide in North County Dublin.
Basically what we have done here in Robswells Park, we have a site here of around 10 acres and we've put five Highland cows on this in order to kind of create the right conditions for the brent geese and other wildlife species.
Brent geese are high Arctic migrants which come to our shores during the winter months, leaving behind temperatures of 30 degrees below zero and 24-hour darkness. By late October, up to 85% of the migrant population that come to Europe congregate on Strangford Loch. Most will eventually spread south along our coastline, before leaving again by late May for their breeding grounds in Arctic Canada, a journey of over 3,000 kilometres, which will take them almost 3 months to complete. Robswall Park in Malahide should be ideal feeding grounds for brent geese. Fingal County Council have come up with an initiative to increase the biodiversity of the land. Hans Visser is their biodiversity officer.
Hello, Hans. You have a great job, I must say. Fingal is an extraordinary county. It's not the whole of Dublin, it's a third of Dublin. But it has a most enriched environment from the point of view of wildlife. Can you outline the wonders of this gorgeous county forest, Hans?
Well, Fingal has plenty of wildlife places to offer, all right. And like the estuaries definitely would be our key features, like it's the Rochestown estuary, the Malahide estuary and the Bald Doyle estuary. Like every year, thousands and thousands of migratory birds come over here, spend the winter here before returning back to their breeding grounds in the Arctic. Then we have the islands off the coast. Again, like Lambay, I think, is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, mixed breeding bird colony in Ireland. And then you have Ireland's Eye, Rockabill, the Skerries Islands. Like all of those have, again, thousands of birds summertime before they sort of leave the coast and for better places. And then I suppose, like, in addition to that, you also have plenty of wildlife around the place as a more in a more generic sense, like between the rivers, the hedgerows, the woodlands. Like there's plenty of farmland, typical farmland species, and the likes of the yellowhammers and tree sparrows, and as you go down to the rivers with the otters and the kingfisher, like it has an awful lot to offer. Basically,
it has. It's a marvelous place. Now we're standing on what's called Paddy's Hill, and Paddy's Hill has, I believe, Neolithic and possibly Mesolithic remains here. So people stood on this hill perhaps up to 8,000 years ago, for all we know. But there's a wonderful view from up here. But right below us, we have pasture. And on the pasture, there are some very interesting cattle. Now, you are managing pasture in Fingal for biodiversity. Can you tell me a little bit about how you're going about that?
Well, the whole grazing idea basically is part of a much bigger project, which is Growing Places. It's an initiative by Fingal County Council to kind of make our open spaces a bit more attractive. Like over the years, we have gained an awful lot more open space, but it's a lot of mown grass. So what we would like to do is, I suppose, to try to make it a bit more diverse. So like we will be doing sort of planting more daffodils to kind of get a bit of spring colour, more tree planting. The wildflower meadows will be part of that, planting herbaceous schemes. And the cattle really was like another extension of that to kind of, like say, like in sort of in relation to this particular park here on Paddy's Hill in the Robswells, where you actually have sort of cattle now grazing the parks. And the cattle are being grazed in a number of different locations as well, like there's St. Catherine's Park in Lucan, and there we've got grazing going on our Turfy Nature Reserve, and then the Racecourse Park in Baldoyle as well. Again, it's just to try to see, I suppose, it adds something for people because it kind of puts a bit of life back in the park, but what it also does, I suppose, for specific biodiversity gain, where we try to create the right conditions for certain plants and animals. tourists that we're, I suppose, we're trying to encourage back into those places.
Now, this field where the cattle are is how big, Hans?
There would be around 10 acres here.
2.4 hectares, I think.
That's right, yeah.
Thereabouts. Now, it's quite a nice substantial field. Now, that field, I know it well, was a great haven for Brent geese from around October through to April every year. And you used to cut it, mow it. But you don't do that anymore. You're using the cattle, I think, to do that work for you. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the basic principle. Like, the idea is that we kind of, like, the Brent geese indeed will be the target for this field, and like all, some other the other birds of the estuary will benefit from that as well, like oyster catcher, curlew, and all those. Like anything that sort of benefits from short grass anywhere near the estuaries. The idea is that we have the cattle on it then to kind of create, like, to kind of, I suppose, we have to find the right sort of stocking density in order to create sort of that nice short sward that the geese and the likes that like so much. And once we kind of know that, it is something that we can basically sort of just keep on doing.
I have to tell you that when we heard first there were cattle coming here, and I used to talk to neighbours about it, there was a sort of cattle, what cattle out here? This is not a place for cattle. But then when the cattle arrived, everyone was thrilled with them, because these are no ordinary cattle. And I bring my grandchildren down, and people who are younger than me bring their children down to see the cattle. They are a big take. You didn't choose ordinary cattle. What kind of cattle did you bring in?
Well, in this case, these are Highland cattle. They're quite rugged looking, basically big hairy creatures with big mess of horns on them. Basically, they're fairly primitive looking as such, but they're definitely sort of captured the people's imagination. But like, the reason why we use them is because they're quite suitable for these conditions. Like, they don't need any housing in the winter time. They tend to look after themselves rather well, and that kind of makes them sort of fairly useful for the purpose that we want to use them for. And I think on itself, the whole idea of having these cattle out there can compare to, say, from the more commercial breeds, again, is because these require far less maintenance, far less looking after. They kind of look after themselves, basically. And that's, again, like an important condition for having cattle out here.
Yeah, they're like yak or muskox, or these dramatic cattle you see in films. They're really glorious beasts, I must say, and lovely shaggy hair on them. Of course, they live in the Highlands of Scotland, so Fingal at times, with the east wind blowing in, resembles the Highlands of Scotland when the wind is very strong and there's a blizzard or whatever. But the cattle won't mind that, will they?
No, again, like, because they have such a nice thick coat on them, like, they, like, anything the weather throws at them, basically, like, they should be able to survive that. Like, if the weather gets really extreme, like, they'll be moved, like, to a slightly more sheltered location. And, like, they will, like, if you get a thick layer of snow, then actually, like, for the first couple of days, they can actually still keep on feeding. Because, again, like, if you think about, like, the Scottish Highlands, if they survive the winter there, then, like, this place is here is peanuts for them, in a way. And I think as well, I suppose for us, it's more trying to figure out, like, or even trying just to see, okay, like, how does this work on this site? We started last year with this in St. Catherine's Park and Lucan. That's a floodplain grazing site as part of sort of a demonstration project there of how to maintain floodplains, and that actually worked really well. Like, the public response there was really, really good as well. Like, again, when we put up the fence, we got a lot of complaints, like, why are you doing this? Because as soon as the cattle arrived, like, oh my god, this is great. And that's where, like, when we kind of learned from that, we're like, okay, well, this actually seems to be working. So now we have added, like, another two locations to it, and again, just to see again how it will work here, how many cattle do we need to kind of create the habitat that we're looking for wildlife. And then again, like, you know, if this is working here as well, we can just kind of keep on rolling, like, this particular approach, and perhaps in other places as well where it's suitable for it.
Well, now, will the cattle be kinder to the flora and fauna, do you think, than mowing it with a machine?
Well, I suppose, like, in relation to this here, like, this particular site used to be mown every 2 or 3 weeks. Now, the only thing that you're going to get there is just short, immediate grass with nothing else in it. Mm-hmm. Now, in a way, again, that will suit Brent geese, I suppose, during the winter time. But I suppose what we're after is a bit more diversity than just that. And I think with the cattle, because I suppose the way they graze it, like, you're going to have some rougher patches, you're going to have shorter patches and the likes of that. That is going to benefit not only sort of the plant life, but anything sort of, like, as you kind of go up the ecosystem, when you kind of look at more insects and more birds and everything as well. So again, it's trying to find that balance between, like, a really short sword sort of in the autumn time for the geese, while at the rest of the year where you have a slightly longer sort of a bit more grass, a bit more flowers and the likes of that, in order to kind of get other creatures in as well. So that's really where the overall benefit comes in from a grazing perspective. And then we have another site in Baldoyle in the Racecourse Park where that land was so undulating, it was very hard for our machines even to start maintaining that. And again, from that perspective, like from a practical perspective, it's just really good just to have livestock doing that, basically.
Well, now the Highland cow is famous for ferreting out plants and things that the ordinary cow would never find. He's able to exploit, he's able to use his big horns to shift the snow out of the way and get at plants and things that are growing that no ordinary moo cow would ever dream were there at all. Now, this suggests to me, however, that this is probably the opposite to what you want, because these cattle are going to find the plants and things and flowers that other cattle would not. And they will probably eliminate them, will they?
Well, this is again like one of the things that we're basically what we're trying out. It's just like by using the right stocking density, you're always going to have places that are not so intensely grazed, and that will allow those flower space to thrive. And that's why sort of at every site throughout the year, we just have a look to see how sort of the vegetation develops, and we kind of look at sort of the insect life, bird life, and the likes of that, because that will kind of give us the right information that we need in order to kind of make those sort of slight alterations if we want to kind of go do like get a bit more shorter grass, then put more cattle on it. If you want it slightly less, then take some of the cattle off. And like I said, it is a bit of a balancing act. We haven't really tried it long enough to kind of get exactly the right menu of options basically that we need for each site. And that's why, like I say, we started, and it's now a matter of just monitoring it and altering it where necessary.
So you have three cows and two calves, and what is their eventual destination? Will we be eating them in a few years' time, or what?
Yeah, they are destined for the plate, all right. Again, the idea really is, one of the things, the way we kind of see it, that this is another way, I suppose, of providing local produce. So not only, I suppose, like, I'd make the park a bit more interesting to kind of look at, but in the end, I suppose, once they kind of mature, the idea would be that that people, like, as part of some sort of a buck scheme, for example, that people actually can buy the meat that has been produced locally. And I think that's, like, I suppose, if you want to make nature conservation pay for itself, then this is one way to do that as well, where on itself, like the cattle are kept here, they achieve their conservation targets. It makes it, like, the park look a bit more interesting, while at the same time also being able to provide some sort of local produce for people that can buy it here that live around the corner. So you can basically see where your food is being produced as well, and you can see how it has been raised and the likes of that under very natural circumstances and without any artificial additives and the likes of that.
Okay, now Richard, the cattle are here in the field at the back.
I see.
As you can see, they're just up here at the top of the field.
Oh, very nice, yes.
Are we on granite or are we on limestone in this part of the world?
It's granite.
So you're Wicklow. You're not Dublin.
that'll raise a few questions, all right? Oh,
indeed.
And a few arguments.
The cattle in Rob's Wall didn't come from the Scottish Highlands, but from a farm in Glenasmall on the Dublin-Wicklow border. Farmer Peter Jones.
Now, Peter, how long have you been raising Highland cattle, and why did you start doing it in the first place?
Basically, farming here in the valley, I've been here all my life, and the father has been farming here, and we've always had a couple of rare breeds. Throughout the years, we've had Kerries and we've had Irish Moilies, and we decided to try something, and Highlands was the next thing we hadn't tried. And we said we'd try that, and I went to Scotland and I seen what was in Scotland, and there seemed to be a market there for the beef, and to come on and give us a good carcass weight. Plus they looked majestic. When we looked into it a little more, we went down sort of the biodiversity route. And for the mountains where we are, it seemed like a logical alternative to go with was the Highland cattle. To bring them in and put them on the mountains and see how they went.
So they suit this kind of terrain.
They do.
You mentioned the Kerry cow there, and the Kerry cow is a cow of similar kind of terrain, rushy fields and soft kind of ground. How do these fellas compare with the Kerry cow?
We found, when they arrived originally, which is about 4 or 5 years ago, we bought three cows in originally, and we brought them in on the very bad winter with all the snow. And the three cows came in and they stood in the middle of the field, and we gave them hay. And they were quite happy there with a little square bale every day. They come over. Icicles were hanging down to the ground off their fur, and they were quite happy. We found with the Kerries before, the Kerries didn't do as well on the mountain during the winter. We nearly had to bring them in and put in shelter for them. Whereas so far with the Highlands, nothing seems too rough for them. They spent the winters on the mountain, and they've been quite happy. And they've been more at home on the mountain, where the Kerries wouldn't be quite as at home. They'd want to come down into the greener pastures for the winter.
Yeah, I suppose that stands to reason, really. They're highland cattle, and of course the Kerry Gow is a lowland beast, I suppose. Now, when you say you brought them in, did you bring them from Scotland?
No, we brought them. The first ones came in from, I think we went to Cork for the first ones. I brought them into the holding here. Now, in recent times, we've brought in a bull from Scotland. The rest of them we've bred up from there.
So there is a slim tradition of breeding highland cattle in Ireland?
Yes, there is a couple, and my father tells me 20 or 30 years ago there was a herd of them on the Sally Gap originally. Now, I never remember them, but people have told me about them. So yes, there is. And even in this area there's has been known to be some.
Now, you see figures for cattle in a field and reasonably good land use. I'm told about 0.6 of a cow per hectare or something like this. This is something kind of half a hectare to gives you sustains a cow. Yeah. Now, up here with this land, how many hectares would sustain a cow?
Probably a little bit less because of the bad ground. But with the mountain we have, there's so much ground up there that has been unutilised. There is plenty, and especially with the Highland cattle, we give them good forage, but they seem to happier to go and graze the heather and the different plants that does grow on the mountains, and they're quite happy up there seeking out a living, if that be the way.
Now, if we had Frisians or Shorthorns or something here working away, they wouldn't really exploit the place very well. Not anything like as good as these guys. They wouldn't eat all the plants. Is that right?
Well, originally when we brought the couple in from Scotland, we had to go through a period of quarantine, say. Mm-hmm. So we had ground, good ground down the road. And as you say, we put them into it. And it was the month of May, so there was plenty of grass everywhere. And we found within 6 weeks or 8 weeks, we found that you'd go over in the middle of the day, and we'd find the cattle not out in the middle of the field eating the grass, but in the bushes, eating back the hawthorn and the briars and all this sort of thing, which we were amazed at. And when we finally took the cattle out of the field, there was a great job done on the fences and the hedges. It had all been trimmed back nicely.
Isn't that remarkable? The Scots bred them for exploiting marginal habitat and eating things that other cattle wouldn't eat. Is that the case with these?
That's what we're finding with them. They're very good, and especially on the mountain terrain, they're browsing back the heather. They're seeming to look like they're starting to control the vegetation on the mountain.
So they'll eat young heather shoots and that kind of thing, keep the heather down at a very viable level. Don't let it get all woody and stringy and unusable for anything else.
And breaking paths through it and just breaking up the heather. We find with the highlands, they're very light on their feet. So they're not damaging. They are breaking through the heather, but they're not damaging the ground as such.
So you're a trendsetter. You're showing that these cattle can exploit whole areas of Ireland which at present are not being exploited because of their curious eating habits and their curious ability to exploit these very tough and unusable plants that other cows won't eat. Is that right?
That's where we're heading, or trying to head, and trying to seek a living ourselves out of what we have here.
So now, has the place changed since they came? The terrain, looking around, have you seen their mark on the landscape, would you say?
When we see them on the mountain, there is better paths for the sheep to be going through, which is opening up everything else on the mountain for the animals to move more freely through the forage, basically.
Now, if a botanist were here, I feel they might say that these cattle are eating everything, you know, and there's things that ordinary cattle would miss and might thrive as a result of being missed by the cattle, will now be gobbled up by these characters. And they might argue that, in fact, these cattle are reducing the biodiversity rather than extending it. Well, would you agree with that suggestion?
Well, I would hope that they would be actually adding to it, as in the more hardy plants that would be taking over because they're not being grazed back, they're helping to cut them down and give way to the lesser plants, lesser vigorous plants that would be gobbled up anyway by the stronger plants.
So the bullying plants that monopolise the whole place get eaten away, and it gives a chance to these fellas, these other lesser plants, to survive. Yeah. Now, the other side of the thing, the other end of the cow is his backside. Presumably, these guys then are producing a vast amount of very useful dung with a huge enriching effect on the landscape too.
Yeah, and what we have found is with the dung is bringing new life, because the little insects are coming to feed on the dung, which is adding to the food chain, basically, for the other animals.
And they're all coming along and eating the insects in turn. So you have an ecosystem developing. So this is, in fact, enriching the environment.
I would hope so.
Now, if you turn to the other side of the coin, your gain, the money you get from raising these, does it take much longer for a cow to mature here? In other words, will you get as much meat in a given time from these as you would from conventional cattle farming?
With the Highlands, they're given a sort of three-year period to finish the bullocks for the meat, which would be a lot longer than conventional cattle. But what we're finding is they're not taking anything like the amount of feed to get them there. So they are thriving on the mountain for the period, and then we're finding we're bringing them down and just having to let them out on a bit of good grass for the last 6 weeks, which gives a nice finish to the meat.
So even if it gets very cold and snowy and so forth, you won't have to take these cattle in, whereas you would with ordinary cattle, is that right?
That's right. And we found when we did take a couple of them in, they sweat terrible bad in the shed. They don't like the shed.
They don't like it.
And they even lose condition.
And I noticed you have a big flock of geese here, a lovely flock of white geese, and they're a kind of similar kind of animal. They do their own feeding. All you do is you give them the ground and they look after themselves. There's a bit of that about these fellas, is there?
They're about the same, yeah. They're the same, interested in the same things. And we find, especially with the cattle, there's very little to be done with them. A bit of feeding every now and then, and they're happy out.
The Highland cow, it seems, is ideal for this biodiversity project. But will it work? Hans Visser.
Because we started quite late with the grazing, because it took us a little while to kind of get the cattle up here, and now we just have to see, like, how long does it take for them to kind of get the grazing down? Whether it will be 2 or 3 weeks, but if I look at it now, I don't think so. There's not enough of them to kind of achieve that particular target, but the whole point would be that we have them here until sort of later this winter without sort of providing any additional feed. So the bit of grass that might be a bit taller now, so like the geese will have to use some of the other shorter like areas basically behind us, but then as the winter progresses and the shards get shorter and shorter, that's basically when the geese will be able to start using this. And as again, it's the short grass in the end that we kind of want by the time between sort of January, February, for that basis that the geese will can start using it. And hopefully the next year, because the cattle will be in place, we can actually achieve that sort of result a bit earlier than we were able to do that this year.
So it will be very interesting to see what wild plants come up now in the spring with the cattle here, a more natural system, a grazed system rather than a machine-determined system. So it will be very interesting to see what comes up. And have you kind of data already on what this field looked like before you put cattle in, so that you can compare it with the results of putting them in this winter?
Well, it was very basic stuff. It was a bit of like daisies and lolling perennial, like an ordinary ryegrass basic. So anything really that's got added to that is beneficial in a way already. But yeah, the idea basically is that sort of like throughout the growing season, we're just going to get have a look in the field to see sort of what basically pops up. And that kind of like that, I suppose it is part of a learning process here. Like, because for, as I said before, like the whole idea is that we have to find out sort of what suits each site. The cattle numbers are different. What was there originally in the soil? Like, what sort of seed source is there still in the soil? We don't know. And I suppose by trying this, we'll be able to see sort of what comes out of that in the end.
It's a very salty soil anyway, because the wind sweeps in. So it's interesting, but there are skylarks here in the field next door. You have skylarks, which is getting very rare now in Europe. You get snipe in winter, curlew. Wheatears seem to like it on their way through in the autumn. So this is quite a diverse habitat, and it will be very interesting to see how your cattle have affected that. Thank you, Hans.
All right, no problem.
In part two, we visit the ancestral home of the Highland cow. We talk to a Scottish farmer. A poet and storyteller tells us of her love for cattle, and we pay homage at the shrine of a famous Scottish ornithologist.
B- Basically, what we have done here in Robsworth Park, we have a site here of around 10 acres, and we've put five Highland cows on this in order to kind of create the right conditions for the Brent geese and other wildlife species.
In the first part of this programme, Hans Visser told us about a project undertaken by Fingal County Council to increase the biodiversity at Robsworth Park in Malahide, North County Dublin. The plan involves a small herd of Highland cattle managing the 10-acre site in a more natural way. The hope is that birds, including Brent geese, will feed here during the winter months. The cattle belong to Peter Jones, whose farm is in Glenasmall on the Dublin-Wicklow border.
Presumably these guys then are producing a vast amount of very useful dung with a huge enriching effect on the landscape too.
Yeah, and what we have found is with the dung is bringing new life, because the little insects are coming to feed on the dung, which is adding to the food chain basically for the other animals.
And they're all coming along and eating the insects in turn. So you have an ecosystem developing. So this is in fact enriching the environment.
I would hope so.
The Highland cow is an iconic and inspirational animal, celebrated in poetry and song.
The song is Colin's Cattle, and it's the Scots version of the Gaelic song. It's about the Highland cows, you see. It's in by Glen Eye and Glendee's winding mere, fae Glen tether, a-chasing the deer. The Kyo, my Colin, a-grazing the ben. There speckles the grouse, broons the bonny mere hen. So it goes like that.
Aberdeen-born Sheena Blackhall is a celebrated poet, writer and singer.
As a poet, sometimes you get involved in queer things. And there was somebody came up to Aberdeen doing a wee workshop on psychosynthesis, they called it. It was a sort of Jungian thing to encourage creativity. And for a ridiculous sum of money, you had to go to a flat and lie down on the floor, and this person would talk you through, you know, a sort of visualisation business. So, because I'm quite on the large side, more sort of Highland cowish than other, I was put out in the lobby with the door open and lay down there. But you had to visualise this special house, and the door was opening, and something very special to you would come out. And the only thing that came out my door was this huge cow. And, you know, with imagination, I'm trying to shove it back in through the door, but it just kept coming. Great big lumbering brutes, and it was a Highland cow. And it was lactated, and there was milk pouring out of it in our directions. But other folk got nice things, like gods and goddesses and all that, but I had this Highland cow.
That encounter with the Highland cow was in Sheena's subconscious, but she had a first-hand encounter with a cow in India.
I did a wee trip across to India ages ago, and I was quite interested, because I like cows, to see they held up the traffic there, and I thought, this is amazing. And also, if a cow gets run down in Delhi, they've got hot cow hospitals called gonadons. So, I mean, the driver of the bus or whatever hit them, he might struggle to find a hospital, but the cow's whipped away and sorted out.
Not surprisingly, Sheena has written poems about cows.
This particular poem, I was down at there's a Buddhist retreat centre. There's one in Dublin, and there's also one in Balquhidder, the same group. It's Triratna. They always go for a peaceful place or a pleasant place. So I was off wandering about the loch, Loch Voyle, and came face to face with this Highland cow. So we just sat down, and it was chewing away, and I was looking at it, and I just wrote the poem about it. So here it goes. Highland cow. The cello slits on her nose, release a melodious moo. Her copper pelt is soft as maiden hair. Spittle sits in the silky folds of her mouth, like seeds of milky dew. Through the heavy fringe at her eyes, a bovine boadicea, horned and hairy, she watches me unblinking, turns the rump of her udder, snorts and leaves, ponderous as a liner, slipping out of a narrow harbour, the brown tow of her tail, swinging medallions of dung. So that's the English one. I did a wee one for Bairns and Scots. and it's called the Healing Coo. Moo, 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 I'm a healing coo. Twa horns for a hat and a winner for view. I dinna eat sweeties or scurly or stew. Moo, 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 I'm a healing coo.
It's my famous hairy beefsteak pies, folks. Now it's 100% steak in my pies. There is no fat, there is no gristle. The steak melts in your mouth, as does the pastry. Now, money back guarantee in any fair product if you don't enjoy. If you're having a job getting a decent slice, that's an old butcher's recipe. There's a high meat content in my slice. Same with my steak burgers. They're 80% pure Healing Coo steak in my steak burgers. There's four in each pack.
The Scots are very fond of the Highland cow, but they don't regard it as sacred, as we discovered when we paid a visit to the farmer's market in Paisley.
Not you today? £9.75, please, ma'am. It's all feasible, okay? £10 you've given me. Enjoy. Thank you.
My name is Archie McIntyre. Our family has been farming and breeding Highland cattle in the region of 75 years now, and we're into the third generation to do so. We run a fold of Highland cattle of about 30 breeding cows and foalers. And this is the Paisley market we're at today. We're here twice a month, but any month concerned, we do 20 to 22 farmers' markets in the central belt of Scotland, selling Highland beef.
Archie McIntyre knows all there is to know about Highland cattle.
Hello, Archie.
Hello, Richard.
I've come all the way from Ireland to talk to you about hairy cattle. When I was at school, we used to have a poem which began, "Behold her singing in the field, yon solitary Highland lass." Of course, the poem is about a woman, but we always thought of it as a cow, one of your Highland hairy cattle. So it's great to be here to talk to a real Highland farmer who has raised these cattle, and we want you to tell us all about them.
The Highland cattle is one of the original beef cattle in Scotland. Their colour originally was black, where they were called the black cattle. Since then, as the years has went on, we've moved into different colours from red, brindles, duns, whites, etc. They're a very hardy breed. They can outwithstand any winter elements that's thrown at them. They're tremendously good for foraging on rough ground. They're used quite a lot for conservation work in Scotland, taking in, you know, rough terrain. They're very mobile cattle, and they can easily on any kind of terrain that you put to them.
So they're just the thing to have if the land is fairly marginal, steep or rocky or whatever, because it can ferret out plants that other cattle couldn't. Is that the way they work?
That is correct, yes.
Well, now, if it's doing that, and it's very hairy and well insulated, does that mean it has less fat on it? Does that mean a better cut of meat?
Go back to your first question of being hairy. The Highland cattle have two coats. They have an undercoat of a very fluffy, just like a duck actually, they're an undercoat of a very fluffy hair. Then hence on the top there's a long hair which grows over so that the reins run straight off their backs or off their cattle, right?
Just so they, like a duck, as you said.
It's similar to what a duck is, yes.
And do you use that hair for anything when you kill the cattle? It's a pity to throw it away, it would seem.
Some people have tried it, but it's not as successful. It's not a thing that's been pursued. The only thing that I've seen done with them is the hide made into rugs, you know, an actual hearth rug. But that's about the only thing.
That's keeping the outside hair in the hide, is it? The long hair?
Yes, keeping the whole thing on.
Anyone try it in pillows, like eider down or anything like that?
No.
It wouldn't work, would it?
No, it wouldn't work in that. Yeah. You mentioned about lean or fat meat.
Yeah.
Highland cattle are famous for being lean meat, red lean meat. Yeah. They have a very low fat content. We're roughly about 4.6 fat as compared to other cattle, which are well over 12% fat.
So the other cattle use a layer of blubber, like a whale, to keep warm, whereas your fella doesn't do that. He uses the coat to keep warm, so he doesn't need to have the fat. So therefore the meat is leaner.
That is correct.
Well, that raises the issue of why Highland cattle aren't more widely used. Is there a downside to this? Is the meat in some ways not very satisfactory or whatever?
The meat from the Highland cattle, and it's quoted by quite a number of people, is the best beef in the world. For the reason being The animals are mature before they're slaughtered. Normally, if you take your other animals, they're all probably slaughtered between 16 and 24 months. The Highlanders are not slaughtered until they're over 30 months. So the beef is actually mature before the animal is slaughtered.
But the downside is it takes longer to get to the downside,
if there is a downside, and I don't think there is, because your Highland cattle is not going to take as much feed as what another native breed would take, or continental. Your Highlander will fatten off the grass that you have got for it.
Yeah, it's a self-perpetuating conversion device, converting grass and plants, in this case, other than grass, into meat. The meat is very good.
Yes.
Now, if I came along and showed you some meat, would you be able to tell me that came from a Highland cow, that came from an Aberdeen Angus, or that came from whatever?
I think that would be quite easily done, because the Highland cattle have a very famous marble through the beef. You know, a marble in the fat through it. They don't have blubbers of fat sticking on the end. They have this marble veins that run through the meat, and it's quite easily distinguished from any other meat.
And is the meat tender?
Very tender, yes.
Now, you have exported these cattle all over the world. They're used in these kinds of habitat, rough, cold, austere kind of places, everywhere in the world, really, aren't they?
Where it's cold. Yeah. Where it's cold, where it's warm, even in Australia.
I see.
New Zealand. There they have adapted themselves to the different climate, and they don't have as much long hair as what we have here in Scotland. Like,
so keeping them, they do it themselves. You don't need to give them any feed. Now, how austere can it get? How cold can it get before you have to take them in and house them? Or do you ever have to take them in and house them?
You don't have to take them in and house them. There's some people will take them in and house them, largely not for the cattle, but for the underground feed work, where it's probably wet and they don't have a dry bed to lie on. Your extremes, you're asking what they'll come into. Well, they're in Poland, where at sometimes I think it's minus 40 it can be.
Are they entirely used for beef? You never milk them, do you, or anything like that?
Not nowadays. In the old days, when Highland cattle come into the being, they were used as a house cow as well, so that they were milked, and back years ago to produce the milk, and the milk is very creamy. That's why the calves do so well, because the milk has a tremendous cream in it.
Very high level of fat. Like
there is a good
animals.
Fat, yes.
But the problem presumably is, how do you milk them? They're out on mountainy kind of places, rocky places, hard to get to. How do you get out? You bring out your little three-leg stool and sit
under
the cow.
Yeah, you could do that, yeah.
Would it allow you to do that?
The Highland cattle are as docile an animal as you'll find if they're handled correctly and handled when they're young.
That's an interesting line, because we have suddenly got Highland cattle where I live, and people love them, but they're all terrified to go into the field because the cow looks so fierce with his long horns. They're terrified of going in. The farmer, in fact, is using that as a way of making sure nobody goes near his cattle. They look intimidating, but in fact, that's a mistake to think that. They're actually very docile, is that right?
Very much so, yeah.
I see. The horn is, of course, a weapon. He could, like the yak or the muskox or his relatives, these big hairy relatives of Arctic and Himalayan conditions. He uses the horn as defence. These animals use the horn as defence. Does the Highland cow use it as a defence, or does he use it just for shifting snow or whatever to get at plants?
The Highland cow will use it in defence if it has a young calf at foot and something is trying to interfere with the calf. Yes, then it will use the horn in that respect.
Now, you farm these cattle, and presumably your father and maybe your grandfather did it before you. How long is the Highland cow tradition going on in your family?
I would say in the region of 75 years.
And these are your favourites? You don't have Aberdeen Angus or Frisians?
No.
Short horns. Am I insulting you by mentioning these?
These are bad words.
Are they bad words? I see.
Because they're nothing like Highland cattle.
Of course there's nothing like this. Yeah. You sounded like coming out of a religious zealot or something like this. Won't tolerate any kind of error, you know.
Yeah.
So you are raising them and you love them and so forth. And you know all your cattle individually. They have names, have
they're
they?
They're all named, yes.
And you feel very sad when the day comes and they've got to be carted off and slaughtered?
there is that element to it as well, but you just have to put your best foot forward, and that's the nature of the beast, and that's what it was intended for.
So it's like us all, our day comes and...
Our day comes.
A generation cometh and a generation goeth, yeah. But the earth abideth forever, as they say. Now, you keep a bull for posterity and so on?
Or do you
hire in a bull?
No, we keep a bull of our own. Going back to your thing with the Highland cow, is a long liver.
How long?
You can have Highland cows at 20-year-old and still have a calf at foot.
And if I can mention some of these awful breeds like Friesian and Aberdeen Angus, how long will they live?
Probably about half of that.
Will they? Yeah. That quick? I see. But you would slaughter them, of course, long before that.
Oh, no. I know a place where there's cows at 23 and 24-year-old.
But they weren't slaughtered for their beef. And will they?
No, they were for breeding, and they're still breeding yet. At that age.
I see. So you keep separate ones for breeding?
Oh, you've got to have your breeding stock, and then... What you don't use for the breeding stock goes to the beef side. All steers, all bull calves, it's just made into steers. Heifers that are not good enough for breeding quality, they all go to the butchering side.
I see. Well, now, when you take cattle in Ireland, they're in the lowlands, and there's all kinds of parasites and things, and flies and fluke, and things that live in the gut, and things that hit their skin, and so on and so forth, and they're constantly being treated or having preventive things given to them to avoid these kinds of things. Now, up in the highlands, and it's colder and it's more austere, there should be less of these things. So, on the one hand, that should be good for the cattle. In another, it should leave them rather open if they're taken out of the highlands down to a milder climate. They should be more vulnerable to that. What is the picture with regard to these kind of parasites and diseases? Is it better or worse?
It's basically the same, even in the highlands, even with the cold. It's basically the same. And it would be advisable for someone just on a yearly basis to give them a dose as normal. It's not going to do them any harm.
It's the same. Yes, they're not any more prone, and they're not any more immune to these horrors than
the only thing that you can say that they're immune to, they can get tick acclimatized. That means if you're born in a tick infested area, then they'll be tick acclimatized.
Well, now, have you a special name for, say, the herd? We talk herds of cattle, but you don't use that word.
It's used a fold.
A fold
of Highland cattle.
And it's only Highland cattle. You wouldn't refer to an Aberdeen Angus fold, would you?
No, that would be heresy.
So the pure brethren, the members of the religion are all in the fold.
In the fold, yes.
They're lovely. See, with potatoes and veg for a quick dinner, if you're looking for... They're succulent enough, you hardly need gravy with them. And you're getting a nice flavour of the Highland cow. That you today? Money back guarantee in any for a product if you don't enjoy.
Before leaving Paisley, Richard suggested we take a stroll down to the Abbey and pay homage to a famous ornithologist and son of Paisley.
Derek, of course, this is the famous Abbey of Paisley. It's a beautiful medieval building, a church building still in use, very intact, I must say. Now, if you look to the left, you will see two statues. Now, the one on the left, I think we should go and look at it. It's kind of a pilgrimage for me to come and look at this particular statue.
Are you going to give me any clues as to who it is?
Well, the name on, when you get to it, we will see that the name is Wilson. Now, what does the name Wilson conjure up for you?
Well, it means lots of things. Jim Wilson in Cork, our man in Cork. Is it Jim Wilson? No.
It's not Jim Wilson's ancestor, as far as I know, but there is a connection with Jim. Indeed, there is several connections with Jim. Jim is a great man for the Antarctic and voyages and things, and there is a bird called Wilson's Petrel, which raises the heartbeat of an Irish ornithologist when he hears there's a Wilson's Petrel out there. And this
is it the father of American ornithology, that Wilson?
It is exactly the same guy. Wilson's Phalarope and several other Wilson-named
birds. There's his name, Alexander.
Alexander Wilson, yes, the late 18th century. He is considered to be the founder of American ornithology, and he was born here in Paisley. And he was a bit of a poet and writer and a bit of a wag by the sound of it, because he did something that brought him into the local prison. He lampooned a local bigwig, I think it was some kind of a businessman or something like that. He wrote a poem about him, and this character didn't like what was being implied, and he took an action against Wilson, and Wilson lost, and he was forced to burn his book in public, I gather. and was put in jail. And when he got out of jail, he went off to America. And as they say, the rest is history. There he became interested in ornithology. And if you look at this statue, he is holding a dead bird. Now, it's a pity it's a dead bird, I think. You know, it would be much better if it was a live one. But he is holding a dead bird. He's examining it. He has a pen in the other hand. So he became the founder, really, of American ornithology. He produced a nine-volume Birds of America, Illustrated Birds of America. He died before the ninth volume was completed.
He died in Philadelphia, according to the plaque.
Indeed, yes, around 1813 or something like this. But he died there. But he produced this magnificent illustrated account of the birds, 200 and something birds in America, including something like 25 birds that were not known to science at that time. Now, of course, he's a bit overshadowed in the illustration world by John James Audubon. John James Audubon came after him, of course, and Audubon produced the famous Birds of America, this great famous book. If you had a copy of the original Birds of America now, it would be extremely valuable. I have a copy of it, but it's not a real copy. It's not an original copy, but it is a beautiful book. But our good friend from Paisley is the founder of ornithology in the United States.
You're listening to a special Mooney Goes Wild programme about Fingal County Council's biodiversity project in North County Dublin. Highland cattle are being used to naturally manage a 10-acre site in Malahide in the hope that brent geese and other bird species will feed there during the winter months. In part three, we meet Helen Boland of the Irish Wetland Bird Survey, who tells us why Ireland is important for brent geese. And the director of the Botanic Gardens, Dr. Matthew Jebb, discusses the impact the cattle will have on the land.
Where is the greatest density of camels in the world?
Ooh, that's always a tricky one. Probably Saudi Arabia, where there's the least amount of grass.
No, it's in Australia.
Ah,
and
yes, yes.
The camels were introduced to Australia. Now, what is the most hated animal in Australia? The camel. Why? Yes. Because the camel tramples the ground and destroys the plant life. And
makes kicks doors in, I understand. It also raids houses.
Does it? Yes. Oh, that's a terrible sin. Now, this raises a question about grassland and moo cows, cattle.
Welcome back to this special Mooney Goes Wild programme. We've already learned that Fingal County Council have placed a small herd of Highland cattle on a 10-acre site at Robb's Wall in Malahide in North County Dublin. It's hoped in time that the presence of the cattle will increase the biodiversity of the land and make it more attractive to a range of bird species, including brent geese. But what likely impact will the cattle have on the vegetation? Dr. Matthew Jebb is director of the Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin.
The best answer to that is to look at what human beings do to grass. So we're standing here on a mown lawn. This lawn looks like it probably gets mowed once a fortnight or maybe more frequently, right through the summer. And all we can see is grass, nothing but grass. A couple of inches long, but there are no herbaceous plants. There's nothing else. Now, perhaps in spring there'll be a few daisies, but essentially the more you mow grass, the more it turns into nothing but grass. So essentially, there's probably only about four or five species of grass here. And from an ecological point of view, it is very, very boring. There is not much diversity. It's exactly the same height everywhere and the same species of grass everywhere. So what human beings create with a lawn is something they like, a sort of carpet of green, all very even in colour and appearance. But biologically, it's a very dull place.
I see. Well, now, in the state of nature, this is an artificial creation. This is an artifact, really, isn't it?
Yes.
Now, if we went to the plains of Hungary or Mongolia or the Russian steppes, would there be greater diversity among the grasslands there than there is in this case?
Enormously. And if you see a flower meadow that is cut just for hay, so it gets one cut a year, there you will get about 10, 15 species of grass, but about 20 or 30 species of flowering plants, dicotyledons. So unlike the grasses, they've got their little growing points well above ground level and they produce colourful flowers. And that looks amazing. So when we go to the water meadows of the Shannon, the Callows there, it's a very beautiful sight in May and spring, just before the hay crop is cut.
Now, if I don't want to mow the lawn, being a lazy so-and-so, I don't want to mow the lawn, I have three possible options. I can bring in geese, and they will mow the lawn for me. Or I can bring in sheep and they will mow the lawn in a different kind of way. Or I can bring in cows and they will do something rather different again. Now, which of these regimes would you favour?
From the biological point of view, the cows. Because they're very big animals. They like to mooch around and take big mouthfuls of grass, which they usually rip up. A sheep has got a very tight little grazing thing. It's far more like a mowing machine, and it cuts the grass short. Geese do it even shorter. And when you go around certain sites, the Dublin Zoo immediately springs to mind. The lawns there are goose mown. And besides leaving a lot of goose poo around, because I think one goose will produce about 4 yards of goose poo a day, that lawn is incredible. It looks just like a golf course green. And that intense level of grazing actually leads to a very boring sward, a very boring grass meadow. And often it will become dominated not just by grass, but often broadleafed weeds like daisies, because daisy keeps its leaves right low to the ground. And the more you graze grass, the more you encourage daisies, because they can't put up with more than 3 or 4 inches of grass. Once grass gets a little taller, it wipes out daisies. But if you have cattle and in low densities, so that they're picking around and choosing the tastiest bits, gradually it becomes more and more diverse. You get a much better looking meadow with some flowering things all through the summer. There's a diversity of plants.
Now, on the question of diversity, our ordinary cattle that we have here, Frisians and Herefords and Shorthorns and things, they go for the obvious stuff, the obvious grasses and the things that protrude. It's said of the Highland cow that he's a much more intensive animal and that he ferrets out plants and things that the others wouldn't dream of looking for, let alone eating. So on that model, that would suggest that the Highland cow is more detrimental because he's going to eliminate all the strange and unusual things, whereas your ordinary cow will cut away the dominant ones and leave a chance for the more minor ones to develop in its place.
Now, well,
is that right?
This is really a different thing. If you have a highly cultivated meadow and you fertilize it and you grow a crop of Italian ryegrass just for cattle, yes, it's very boring. But an intriguing experiment was done some years ago up in Northern Ireland where they looked at traditional breeds, some of the older Irish breeds of cattle and sheep, and they stuck little GPS machines on them so they could record where that animal moved in the last week, stick them on all the herd, and they compared the big continental breeds, the Charolais and so on, with these traditional breeds. And they found that the traditional breeds would wander all over the hill. They went right up on the hills, came down to the water trough. But the Charolais, they never left that water trough by more than about 100, 150 metres. Very, very lazy animals that they stuck to the level ground and they wanted the water nearby. They're real meat factories. And of course, farmers like this because they're producing more beef per hectare, whereas the traditional breed produces a much lower quantity of beef for a given area. But they wander right up on the hills and the grazing pressure is far less. So you end up with a much more exciting landscape full of flowering plants, a much richer biodiversity.
Now, the hoofs make little bunkers and they dig the ground, they plough it in a certain sense. Do they create little mini ecosystems when the rain comes and so forth, and mosses and maybe liverworts and fungi and things? Is that a case? Are there micro habitats occurring in where cattle roam? Or is this an exaggeration?
No, it's one of the intriguing things is people have been very keen on sowing wildflower meadows in the past few years, probably in the last 15 years. It's become quite a popular thing. And the first couple of years, they're fantastic. They sow, you know, they prepare the ground, they sow this mixture of flowering plants and weeds, and sorry, grasses. And within a few years, it reverts to grass and they're rather disappointed. And what you've got to do is you've got to manage it right. And to manage a wild flower meadow, you've got to give it a real good scratching. You've got to rip out the dead thatch and you've got to leave little bare patches of soil for seeds to germinate on. And what cattle do is they do exactly the right thing. They tear little holes, their hooves make little bare patches, which are the seed beds for the next generation of plants. So they actually increase the opportunities for germination of these flowering things, which if you just have a meadow which you mow once a year, you will find the flowering plants start to fade away and you end up just with a rather boring field of green grass. So
we should have cows in our green areas and estates in the city and so on and so forth. It would be a wonderful thing, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. I mean, and traditionally, every household had a milk cow, and that's just what she did. You know, the little milk cow was always keeping the area around the cottage or farmyard nice and weed-free. And nowadays, where those have disappeared, especially on the islands off the west coast of Ireland, you'll see a lot of briar patches have grown up around the settlements simply because there's not enough grazing animals there anymore. You know, milk is easy to get in a little cardboard container, and that drop in cattle, low intensity grazing, has probably been a big disadvantage to Ireland's biodiversity as a whole.
You mentioned poo there, Matthew. Now, is the poo the dung of cattle? Is it the same in content and in the things it sustains, seeds and parasites and so forth, as the dung, say, of geese?
It's similar in some ways, but the goose poo is far more liquid for a start and very spread out. You know, cowpats, as we sort of traditionally know them, are amazing little ecosystems in themselves, that they are a real lovely habitat for all sorts of fantastic dung flies. And you know, as they decay, you'll see a field that is being farmed organically. You'll see little green patches all over it, and that's where a cowpat has decayed away naturally. And that, just like, you know, on the plains of Africa, the dung beetles and flies and so on, these all sustain insect-eating birds, the swallows and house martins. So they all add to their diversity there, which probably the goose poo doesn't. It washes down into the grass, and it's not as... it probably fertilises the ground to an extent that's detrimental to the biodiversity. Astonishingly, and people are always surprised by this, the lower the fertility of the soil, the richer the floristics of the area. The diversity of plants is much greater. If you fertilise grassland, it really turns into one or two species of dominant grass alone.
So I think, Matthew, that you are a supporter of the Highland Cattle in North County Dublin project.
I think I would be. Yes, I haven't seen any results from it yet, but all the reading I've done about the ecology of grazing would suggest that this is the best way to go about it.
So it seems the presence of Highland cattle at Rob's Wall will have a positive impact on the vegetation. But what about the Brent geese in the area? Helen Boland of Birdwatch Ireland is coordinator of IWEBS, the Irish Wetland Bird Survey.
Yes, it began in the winter of 94-95, following on from what they were doing in the UK, the Wetland Bird Survey, the previous year. So it's been running now for, 20 years almost now. And it's monitoring all of the wintering water birds in Ireland. So that's your swans, ducks, geese, waders and other associated wetland birds.
So teams of counters, both amateur and professional, go out once a month in the winter months, from September on to March, is it? And they count all the birds they see in a particular wetland. And you collate all that information, feed it into a computer, and come up with a map of the distribution of our birds and estimates of how many there are from year to year. Is that more or less what you do?
That's more or less what we do. So we're monitoring to see how species are faring. We're also looking at, it gives us indications how wetland sites are faring as well. And we're also looking at overall water bird population estimates, which is very important. And because the data is gathered over years, it's possible, it's all comparable then. So we can look at if species are going up and down. And it actually all feeds into international population estimates as well. We send all of the information to Wetlands International, which is the organisation, and they're able to produce population estimates of water birds all around the world.
As Matthew Jebb suggests, having cattle on the land will impact in a positive way on the vegetation, but grass is not the main source of food for Brent geese.
The Brent geese, they feed on the intertidal flats, as you know, and their preferred diet, if you will, is a zostera species, it's eelgrass. So that's really the best thing nutritionally for them, and the thing that they go for immediately when they arrive in Ireland. However, that gets depleted quite quickly, and particularly as the Brent goose population has increased so much. I think it was from the 1980s, it was about 25,000 birds, that was the estimate, whereas in 2010, approximately 40,000 birds. So as we were saying, their preferred food is the eelgrass, but then what happens is that gets depleted, and then they move on to, there's other species in Terramorpha and salt marsh grasses and so on, but then they move on to the grassland areas. And in fact, that grassland, even though they, in Dublin particularly, we're so familiar seeing these birds feeding so much on grassland, but it's actually nutritionally inferior for them, although they still thrive on it, I guess, because the population is doing well.
So of the 40,000 Bren geese that come here from Canadian Arctic, how many would come to the Dublin estuaries, do you think?
Dublin is unique in Ireland because there's four different estuaries that are located very close together. We've Dublin Bay itself, Baldoyle Estuary, Malahide, and then Rogerstown, which is the northernmost one. So it's an unusual setup, and obviously the Bren geese love the estuaries. From our counts, I think there's probably from iWebs, there's approximately 9,000 birds. I think Dublin Bay itself, an average number might be 4,000. Baldoyle is about 1,000. And then Malahide and Rogerstown, an average of maybe 2,000 birds in each, which I think adds up to 9,000. But the snag with that is, because so many birds are using the grasslands, when we're doing our counts on the intertidal areas, we're only counting the birds on the intertidal areas, and we do try and count some of the grasslands, but because they're so prolific on the grasslands now, it's almost impossible to try and gather all that information. So I'd say approximately 9,000, but I think that it's probably safe to say that there's more birds than that in Dublin.
So you do counts of all these birds. Now, when it comes to the grasslands on which these cattle are being placed, the relevant animal, well, the relevant bird would seem to be the Brent goose. The Brent goose comes from the Canadian Arctic, doesn't it, yes. Helen? Tell us a little bit about the lifestyle of the Brent goose.
Well, they breed up in the high Arctic, up in East Canada, and it's really one of the most remote places you can imagine. And we don't know a huge amount about what way things work for them up there, because I suppose it's a very inaccessible and, I guess, inhospitable place to travel. But they breed in the East Canadian Arctic. They're spread out over such a vast, wide area that I think it's very difficult to even get a handle on the entire breeding situation up there. Well, what I understand, there's not a huge amount of food available to them, so it's so important before they leave Ireland, before they migrate back up to Canada, it's so important that they bulk up on food and get their fat reserves up after the winter in sort of March, April, May, before they leave Ireland. And what happens is they have a staging site, is what it's called, in Iceland. So they stop in Western Iceland on their way back up to the East Canadian Arctic, and they refuel there. So they stay in Iceland for about 2 or 3 weeks, and they really build up their fat reserves again before going back up to breed in the East Canadian Arctic for sort of May, June time. So it's very, very important that they're in excellent condition before they arrive in the Arctic.
So then, having had their babies and so forth, and raised them and molted and got into flocks in the autumn, and the weather's beginning to close in, the daylight length is shortening, this kind of thing, they now have to come back down again all the way to Ireland. Isn't this an equally difficult run, but this time with the family in hands? And you can see the families, can you? You can pick them out in your flocks here.
Yes, they actually tend to remain together. The family groups remain together, and they remain together for the first year, or at least maybe the first 9 months until the following breeding season. And you can pick out the family groups. The juvenile Brent geese have a white fringing on their wings, so it's actually quite easy to pick those out. So it's interesting to look, and that's how we obviously get an idea of what the productivity was like in the previous, when they arrived back here in the winter, to see the productivity in the previous breeding season is by looking at how many juveniles there are. And actually this season, what we're noticing is that there's very few juveniles, so it looks as though the breeding season just gone has been a very poor one.
So the fields into which these cattle are being put now are fields which have been used in the past by Brent geese, or could be used if they haven't been in the past. So the cattle now and the Brent geese are relating to each other in some way. Do you think the cattle will help the geese, or do you think the geese would help the cattle?
Time will tell, I suppose. The way I understand that the cattle work is they're there to graze and to keep the grass short. So in theory, the Brent geese like a very short sward height, is what it's called. So they like it to be short. So in theory, these Highland cows could help the Brent geese in that sense. But then again, I guess the Highland cows are churning up the ground a wee bit more, which is great for biodiversity and species richness and so on. But I'm not sure what effect that will have on the Brent geese. There may not be any, but I don't know that.
So they love things like golf courses and playing pitches and things where the grass is very short, because I suppose the Brent goose is picking up Entomorpha and Ulva and things like that, which are very close to the mud. They're not really equipped for long, stalky things. That's for other geese to do. So presumably cattle would have to graze the sward very tightly in order to suit the Brent geese, or is that a fair expectation?
Yeah, I think that's a fair expectation, all right. I guess there are so many grasslands available to Brent geese at the moment that it may not have any dent, even if there was an effect that turned the Brent geese off a certain site. I think there's so many grasslands available that it may not be any kind of issue at all.
So you would expect that this cattle project would not please the geese so much, but that it could please other birds like these waders a lot more. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, that could well be the case as well. It could end up being a great benefit for species in Dublin at the moment, which is where the cattle have been introduced so far. Like we were saying, if it does improve the quality of grass, that would be wonderful for any of those grassland feeding species of bird, including the Brent geese.
Whether the Highland Cattle Project in North County Dublin proves to be a success or not, this magnificent beast has something to teach us. Unusually for a domesticated animal, it lives harmoniously with nature. Natural selection, it could be argued, could scarcely have produced a creature so perfectly adapted to its austere environment.